Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Under Our Skin, getting real about race and getting free from the fears and frustrations that divide us, by Benjamin Watson, narrated by J.D. Jackson. Introduction. On August 9th, 2014, I turned on the television in my hotel room at the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, where I was at training camp with my team, the New Orleans Saints. I remember thinking, no, not again. As I watched the news reports about how Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, had been shot and killed by Darren Wilson, a white police officer in Ferguson, a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri. Riots ensued and continued over the next several weeks as every news outlet in America descended on Ferguson during a summer when things seemed to be falling apart and no one could make sense of what was happening. Considering that Eric Garner had died in a police chokehold on the streets of Staten Island only a month earlier, and John Crawford had been shot to death by the police while shopping in an Ohio Walmart on August 5th, the national consciousness was on high alert and ready to erupt when word came of yet another questionable death of a black man at the hands of the police. As protests, mostly peaceful, sprouted up in cities across the country, the outcry against police brutality, coupled with looting and civil unrest, prompted my father to say that he hadn't seen scenes like these since the upheaval of the 1960s. Things had gotten scary, and all the facts had not yet been released or even discovered. On August 20th, a grand jury began hearing evidence to decide whether there was probable cause to indict Darren Wilson for shooting Michael Brown. Over the next 3 months, eyewitness accounts and testimony from the hearings were leaked to the media, increasing speculation about what the grand jury would decide. State of Missouri v. Darren Wilson was often the number one story on the major news networks, with constant updates for each sliver of fact or opinion from a plethora of contributing lawyers, law enforcement officials, and civil rights activists. As week one of the NFL season turned into weeks 4, 5, and 6, anticipation mounted. Finally, by mid-November, week 12, we all got our answer. It was a big week in the Saints locker room. After stumbling out of the gate, we were a dismal 4-6 and in desperate need of a home win after two straight losses. Our chance to turn things around would come on November 24th, on Monday Night Football, against a solid Baltimore Ravens team. As the week progressed and we prepared for the game, there was talk on the networks that an announcement about Ferguson was imminent. But as game time approached, I laid aside my apprehension about when that might happen to focus on the job at hand. Though the Saints had fared well in night games in recent years, that Monday night game was not one of them, and we were beaten by the Ravens 34-27. Disappointed about the game and the season in general, I didn't check social media after the game. And because Monday night football games are broadcast in prime time, they're usually not over until after 11 p.m. anyway. That night, all I wanted to do was meet my wife in the family area and go home. It was Kirsten who broke the news to me about Ferguson.
"They made a decision," she said,
and by the look on her face, I could tell it wasn't good. As we made the short drive from the Superdome to our house, she filled me in on the details and on the explosion of response on social media. When we got home, I stayed up until the early hours of the morning, watching the tears, screams, anger, and frustration of people across the nation as they flocked to the streets of their cities. I listened to the legal experts give their opinions and analysis regarding what the grand jury must have seen and heard, or not seen or heard, that led them to determine there was no probable cause to indict Officer Wilson.
After 3 months of waiting and wondering, I was shocked. I was upset. I was disappointed. I wanted to scream and cry at the same time. It wasn't just about Michael Brown. It was about an entire summer filled with questionable encounters in which black men had lost their lives. Sometimes, God lays something on my heart, and I have the urge to write. I had that feeling that night, and I tried to organize my thoughts, but I didn't know where to start. Everything I wrote felt as if it didn't quite capture the message I wanted to convey. I was angry, but I didn't want to respond emotionally and later regret what I had said. I went to sleep thinking about how, and even if, I should say what I was feeling in my heart. The next morning, I decided to simply start writing exactly what I was feeling. We were off on Tuesday, as is customary in the NFL, and I didn't have to be back to work until early Wednesday morning. A teammate was hosting an event for the homeless that evening, so between family time with the kids and attending the charity event, my opportunities to write were sporadic. Later that evening, we stopped at Target to pick up a few household items for a couple who had fallen on hard times. I sat in the car with the kids while my wife went into the store. With my iPhone in hand, I put the finishing touches on the thoughts I had been typing throughout the day in my notes app. When I was done, I hesitated for a moment and thought about the response I would receive for engaging in such a divisive situation. Though I'm not proud to admit it, I even second-guessed whether I should mention the hope I have in God, even though it is truly the anchor for my life. People always say, "Think before you push send." Well, I thought, and then I pushed send, forwarding my response to a friend who helps with my website so that he could post it to my Facebook account, which at the time I had no idea how to do myself. Sitting in the driver's seat with our four kids behind me, I sent the following post. At some point while I was playing or preparing to play on Monday Night Football, the news broke about the Ferguson decision. After trying to figure out how I felt, I decided to write it down. Here are my thoughts. I'm angry because the stories of injustice that have been passed down for generations seem to be continuing before our very eyes. I'm frustrated because pop culture, music, and movies glorify these types of police-citizen altercations and promote an invincible attitude that continues to get young men killed in real life, away from the safety of movie sets and music studios. I'm fearful because in the back of my mind, I know that although I'm a law-abiding citizen, I could still be looked upon as a threat to those who don't know me. So I will continue to have to go the extra mile to earn the benefit of the doubt. I'm embarrassed because the looting, violent protests, and law-breaking only confirm, and in the minds of many, validate, the stereotypes, and thus the inferior treatment. I'm sad because another young life was lost from his family. The racial divide has widened. A community is in shambles. Accusations, insensitivity, hurt, and hatred are boiling over, and we may never know the truth about what happened that day. I'm sympathetic because I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what happened. Maybe Darren Wilson acted within his rights and duty as an officer of the law and killed Michael Brown in self-defense, like any of us would in the circumstance. Now he has to fear the backlash against himself and his loved ones when he was only doing his job. What a horrible thing to endure. Or maybe he provoked Michael and ignited the series of events that led to his eventually murdering the young man to prove a point. I'm offended because of the insulting comments I've seen that are not only insensitive, but dismissive to the painful experiences of others. I'm confused, because I don't know why it's so hard to obey a policeman. You will not win. And I don't know why some policemen abuse their power. Power is a responsibility, not a weapon to brandish and lord over the populace. I'm introspective, because sometimes I want to take our side without looking at the facts in situations like these. Sometimes I feel like it's us against them. Sometimes I'm just as prejudiced as people I point fingers at, and that's not right. How can I look at white skin and make assumptions, but not want assumptions made about me? That's not right. I'm hopeless, because I've lived long enough to expect things like this to continue to happen. I'm not surprised, and at some point my little children are going to inherit the weight of being a minority and all that it entails. I'm hopeful, because I know that while we still have race issues in America, we enjoy a much different normal than those of our parents and grandparents. I see it in my personal relationships with teammates, friends, and mentors, and it's a beautiful thing. I'm encouraged because ultimately the problem is not a skin problem. It is a sin problem. Sin is the reason we rebel against authority. Sin is the reason we abuse our authority. Sin is the reason we are racist, prejudiced, and lie to cover for our own. Sin is the reason we riot, loot, and burn. But I'm encouraged because God has provided a solution for sin through His Son Jesus, and with it, a transformed heart and mind. One that's capable of looking past the outward and seeing what's truly important in every human being. The cure for the Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, and Eric Garner tragedies is not education or exposure. It's the gospel. So finally, I'm encouraged because the gospel gives mankind hope. Within an hour, my wife asked me if I had posted something because her Facebook was going crazy. Since I wasn't an active Facebook user, I had no idea what was happening online. Over the next days and weeks, my post was liked more than 800,000 times, and I was asked to comment on our struggles with race in America on many major networks and talk shows. In the locker room, many teammates, coaches, and staff members said, "That's what I was thinking. I just didn't know how to say it." Lines of communication began to open up about this tough topic. I wish I could have read all the comments on Facebook. Most of the ones I saw were quite moving. Many people talked about the tears running down their faces and the pain they have felt because of racial tensions in our nation. Police officers, including one from St. Louis who contacted me, thanked me for acknowledging their side of the story. Even some celebrities shared my post on their pages, and players from other teams mentioned it on the field after games. I was invited to speak in churches to urge congregations to address the issue of racism, and most important to me, my wife told me she was proud of me. I didn't know what would happen when I wrote down my thoughts, but God saw it as fit to reach a multitude of people. If it opened their eyes, their hearts, and their minds in even the smallest way, I'm honored to have helped to narrow the racial divide, even for a moment. This book now is an expansion of my thoughts about these serious and troubling issues. I'm writing not because I have all the answers, but because I have a lot of questions and concerns about how we as Americans with different skin tones relate to one another. Ferguson was a crucible where long simmering tensions boiled over. Though as black people and white people in 21st century America, we share space and time, Ferguson and other similar situations have shown us how we view the world in totally different ways. I'm writing because we need to have an open national dialogue about the hot-button issues of race that affect us all. I hope this book will challenge people to have serious, healthy discussions about race and racism. I hope this book will encourage people of all races to have these discussions without fear of saying the wrong thing, insulting others, or being condemned by people who don't agree. The time has come to peel back the layers of our own attitudes and beliefs about race and to be honest with ourselves about our issues when it comes to race. Only then will we experience the change we desperately need. I am confident that you will agree with some of the things I've written in the book. I'm equally confident that you will oppose or see differently other issues I have written about from my personal perspective. Part of my purpose is to address the emotions that I and countless others felt that night when the grand jury decision was announced. Emotions that we continue to feel every time the issue of race is brought into the equation. I've changed the order of my original Facebook post, and I combined a couple of entries to allow the manuscript to flow more smoothly. But the message is the same. My wife and I recently welcomed our fifth child into the world. During one of her doctor visits, I had to fill out some paperwork about myself. I wrote down my name, date of birth, and occupation without hesitation. But when I got to race and was asked to check the appropriate box, the options all seemed loaded. Each one immediately conjured up positive or negative images in my head. Some didn't even make sense if you really thought about it. For the first time on a form like that, I selected Other. Not because I'm not proud of my skin color, my ancestry, or my heritage. Because I am. I checked Other because I know that the real humanity, the soul and spirit under our skin, is what makes us who we are. And on the blank line next to Other, I wrote Human. Chapter 1. Angry. I'm angry because the stories of injustice that have been passed down for generations seem to be continuing before our very eyes. Every year, my parents took us kids to see our grandfather in Washington, D.C. I always loved going to visit Pop-Pop, who was my mother's father. He lived on the 11th floor of a high-rise apartment building near the Watergate Hotel, and we'd walk out onto his balcony to see the lights and sights of the nation's capital. To the right, we could see the Kennedy Center. Straight ahead was the Potomac River, and if we looked left, we had a clear view across the plaza of the Washington Monument. To me, even as a kid, it was breathtakingly beautiful. A solitary spire connecting earth to heaven. Every time we visited, I couldn't wait to gaze on it once again. Pop-Pop's place was filled with what I called old people trinkets, knick-knacks, figurines, little statues, and all sorts of souvenirs that Pop-Pop had picked up here and there throughout his life. For us kids, these constituted a kind of toy store. Rows of interesting objects that we could take down, play with on the rug in the living room, and use to create worlds and armies and stories about the lives of make-believe people. Hours of fun. I'm not sure whether we ever realized to what extent these toys represented real memories of the years through which Pop-Pop had actually lived. My grandfather was born in 1920. His grandfather was born in 1860, at the beginning of the Civil War, into an America where slavery had yet to be abolished. And so, as I have sometimes thought about it, I dodged slavery by just 5 generations. To some, that's a long time. Then again, it really wasn't that long ago. Pop-Pop lived right in the middle of that not-such-a-long-time between slavery and me. He grew up in Culpeper, Virginia, only 70 miles from D.C., but light years away in terms of racial attitudes. The limitations that were placed on blacks didn't set well with him, even when he was a young boy. Like many kids, he was just a bit rebellious, but a lot of white people might have called him a delinquent. One hot summer at the age of 13, he decided to jump into the public swimming pool, which of course was designated as whites only. He went ahead and swam in it anyway. Later, his father got a call from the authorities, who demanded that the family pay for the cost of draining the pool and refilling it with pure water. Before my grandfather reached his mid-teens, he moved from Culpeper to D.C. His parents didn't believe he'd live to see his 20s if they stayed in Culpeper, where on Saturday nights, Pop-Pop was able to see burning crosses in the distance, white people having fun on the weekend with their own brand of terrorism. A full six decades after the abolition of slavery, Pop-Pop's world still had separate toilets and drinking fountains for blacks and whites, a distinction validated by the separate but equal standard approved by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1896 in its landmark Plessy v. Ferguson decision. And as Pop-Pop became an adult, he faced limitations in the working world as well. He often told me that I could do whatever I set my mind on doing. "But," he cautioned, "understand that because you're black, there's always a ceiling. You can only go so far up the totem pole." He ran into that ceiling often enough in his life, I think, but he didn't seem to let it stop him. He served his country for several years in the army, and though he never was sent overseas, he put in his time as a supply officer and was honorably discharged. Later, he got a job as a pressman in the government printing office, which became his main employment for much of his life until he retired in 1976. He also maintained a side job as a bartender, working at an officers' club in town and catering various events. Pop-Pop took pride in himself. He was 5'7", slender, and always well-dressed. He wore a handsome Kango hat, which was a variation on a beret, but with a wider brim. I think people back then dressed better than we do today, but Pop-Pop especially cared about his appearance. That went for his apartment, too. He kept it meticulously clean. To this day, when I smell Listerine, I think of the antiseptic smell of his place, and he maintained everything in neat order, with all his old people trinkets lined up and in their places. It was as if he had a plan for his life, was living it out, and was tracking his progress on the shelves in his apartment. He was popular. I remember him always knowing a lot of people while I was growing up. He was very social. Many people along the street would acknowledge him by name as he walked by. He had lived in Washington most of his life and had accumulated friends for a long time. People, black and white, loved him. For all the social limitations faced by a black man in the 1940s and 50s, Pop-Pop had made a good life for himself. If there was a ceiling for a black person, so be it. Pop-Pop seemed intent on making sure his life filled as much of the space under that ceiling as it possibly could. Pop-Pop had several passions. One was golf. He loved playing the game. Some of the little statues he kept at home were of golfers positioned in various stages of their swing. He also had golf balls lying around his place. As a kid, I thought about taking one of his champion golf balls, going out onto the balcony, and throwing it as far as I could toward the Washington Monument. Later in life, Pop-Pop gave me a set of golf clubs, hoping perhaps that I'd become a golfer like him. But it never took. I pursued this other thing instead. Football. Pop-Pop's second passion was Cadillacs. Black people weren't supposed to be able to afford one, and that may have been the source of his passion. He owned a forest green caddy, and was extremely proud of it. He had a lead foot and always drove fast because he could in that thing. He would take us to Safeway, and it was so much fun to sit in the back seat of the caddy without seat belts and slide back and forth while he drove fast and took hard turns. Dangerous, maybe, but loads of fun. And we all survived with glee what was otherwise just a simple trip to the grocery store. Finally, Pop-Pop had one other passion. Dental floss. When he turned 50, Pop-Pop got braces. It certainly wasn't pleasant for him, coming so late in his life. But after the braces were taken off, he developed a new appreciation for good teeth. Part of his daily tooth care obsession involved the near-constant use of dental floss. He was always flossing. Sometimes he actually fell asleep with floss still in his mouth. When he'd nod off like that, sometimes there would be a single string of floss hanging out over his lip and down to his chin. When my sister Jessica and I saw him asleep like this, we'd giggle. Sometimes we'd quietly walk up to him and get really close to his face, and one of us would carefully put a finger close to his mouth to touch the hanging strand of floss. It would move, and we'd stop, trying not to laugh and hoping it wouldn't wake him up. It wouldn't, and we'd get bolder, actually taking the hanging strand of floss between our fingers and starting to pull it. We always thought that maybe sometime we could slowly pull the whole strand of floss out of his mouth without waking him up. But we never went that far, always chickening out at the last minute. Even today when I think of Pop-Pop, I smile a lot, and I laugh at some of the memories. But I remember other things as well. He didn't often reveal it to me because I was just a kid, but he was angry about the racism he'd encountered as a child, as a young man, and as a proud black man in the prime of his life. He didn't usually express his social activism to me, but he would talk to my mom and other adults in the family. I think I could sense it, though, around the edges of his smile, his playfulness with us kids, and his immense joy in the simple passions of life. There was hurt and anger there. It makes me wonder. I wonder about this dapper man in a Kangol hat, who made a lot out of himself despite the limits society imposed on him. I wonder why he so often said to me, "When you're black, there's always a ceiling." Was it because he knew he was living a life destined for limitations and he was just making the most of it? When he said, "You can go only so far up the totem pole," were his words a challenge to me, or were they a warning? Did he want me to know that even today I don't have the same opportunities as white people? Or was he calling me to step up and overcome the obstacles, just as he had? Isn't that the real dilemma of the race problem? What was the message of Pop-Pop's life? Was it all of the above? I wonder. And I wonder why the Washington Monument seems to stretch only halfway up for black people. Why is it that even today in the United States of America, we as a race are so often kept from touching the sky? I'm angry because white people don't get it. I'm angry because black people don't get it either. And now that I've ticked off everyone equally, let me say my piece. 5 generations and 150 years have passed since the abolition of slavery. You'd think that after all this time we'd have reached real parity between the races, that there would be truly equal opportunity, and that we'd be seeing and experiencing fairness in society between blacks and whites. A lot of white people believe that's actually where we are. A lot of black people know we aren't. Certainly by the time of Pop-Pop's life, smack dab in the middle between slavery and the present, you'd think there would have been a lot of social progress, a shaking out of the issues and biases, and a lessening of racial conflicts. If you
sample complete. Ready to continue?